I'm very happy to be here. It's actually been quite a few months since I've spoken at East West, for reasons I can't quite remember now, but I just, my schedule just didn't allow it for a while. Oh, I remember now. I thought I was going to be doing something else this summer that I didn't end up doing. That's why. How many of you are here because you're interested in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras? Okay, and how many of you are here because you're just interested in the other half of the topic, which is the spiritual roadmap? And how many of you couldn't care less? Okay.
I thought of another thing.
Okay.
Spiritual friendship and community.
Okay. Okay. Very good. I asked that question about who's here for what because the class, the topic is really almost two completely different topics. I was just running through myself reading it, and I realized, oh, my goodness, all of a sudden we're turning over into the Yoga Sutras, and I can do both, but I just wanted to know if I had to. I'm actually, this book, the reason this book is involved is, Swami Kriyananda, who is a direct disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda and really has been my spiritual guide for since my early 20s. I was 22 when I first met him. He died in April of this year at the age of 87, which is a big change for all of us who have had all these years of life experience with him. But his body was failing for a long time, and he was finding it increasingly difficult to express himself through it. His consciousness was essentially liberated from his body, but it was hard to move his body around. As long as he was sitting down, as soon as he was sitting down and didn't have to work through it, he became indifferent to it, but even just to move it from place to place became difficult. So he left on the morning of April 20th. He just got up in the morning, was sitting down to have breakfast, and his heart stopped and his breathing stopped just as easy as it could be. He was in Italy. It's a bit of a surprise, but in the last couple of years of his life, he did some of the best work that he did his entire life. He certainly was an example of age as no obstacle. And one of the things he did was he wrote commentaries on the Patanjali Yoga Sutras. The Patanjali Yoga Sutras are centuries old, 1,000 years old, 2,000 years old. Nobody really knows for sure. Patanjali was a great sage, and he wrote these very concise sutras, aphorisms, that essentially are, well, that's where the title came from, a roadmap of progress on the spiritual path. They're very deep. Patanjali was a self-realized master, and everything he said was extremely full of meaning. They were originally in Sanskrit. They have been commented on endlessly in all these centuries since. Many of the commentaries and many of the translations are pretty hard to understand. And Yogananda gave classes on this subject, but he never wrote anything, and toward the end of his life, Swami Kriyananda just felt it was something really worth doing, and in a matter of just a couple of weeks. He also retranslated almost all the sutras and often had really rude things to say about the translations that he'd seen that were just completely bewildering. And part of the confusion people had in understanding them who were English-speaking was just that the translations were so confused. But he had the spiritual authority to clarify that. So this is a really superb book. It's essentially the confluence of three great souls. Patanjali himself, Paramahansa Yogananda's teachings, because what Kriyananda wrote is what he learned from his guru, and then Kriyananda's own reality. So it's very, very powerful and worth reading. And even though the sutras are very elevated, the commentary makes it more realistic. But it's not a book... How would I say? It's not exactly a book for beginners, although it's a good place to start. It's not for beginners in the sense that Patanjali just said, if your goal is God realization, this is how you get there. So it's for people who are serious about the spiritual path or who have an intellectual interest in scripture and scriptural commentary. If you're just coming to just relieve a little stress, maybe you don't want to start there. But I'll also draw some parallels from it. So I'm going to come back to the Patanjali book or sort of weave it into what we're doing. I'm giving a whole class series every Tuesday night in our temple up the road in Palo Alto, which also appears a couple of days later on the Ananda Palo Alto website, because everything that I do, including this, ends up being posted on that website, and it's a free download. So if you're seriously interested in Patanjali, I'm up to class 16. I'll do probably about 50 classes just starting from the beginning. So if that's your serious interest, I encourage you to do that, because this book is really life-changing. I happened to be traveling in India last winter when it was published, and it was published there before it was in America. I landed in Bangalore and had 3 days before my program started, and I was staying in the guest room of a friend, and basically had 3 undisturbed days in which I just sat and read the book. And I felt like I walked into the room one person and I walked out somebody else. I mean, it was that transformative. I read it twice during that period of time. Because of the confluence of their three consciousnesses, it was like a triple effect. Plus the ideas that were presented there. And I'll just sort of begin there. My habit in a class like this is usually to talk for a while and at a certain point either invite questions, or if I get going really strong, you won't get a chance for a while. But if you hold it in your mind, you might find me answering it anyway, so we'll see. I myself have been a serious student of meditation and of self-realization really since about 1965. As soon as I reached the age of reason, 18, 19 years old, by the grace of God, I was introduced to the principles of self-realization as taught first by Ramakrishna and Vivekananda, which is a very elevated expression of these teachings. And then I used to go to East West Bookstore, which was then in Menlo Park and wasn't associated with Ananda. I didn't even know about Ananda. It was the only place, there was no internet then, it was the only place you could find books like this. And I and many other people would just go there. It was the wellspring of all knowledge, and just go buy book after book and read through certain sections of those books, all the books I could by Ramakrishna and Vivekananda. And then I became extremely interested in how you changed from really thinking these ideas were fascinating into making your life, this is really going to be, let's see if that'll work. How you made it, went from just loving the ideas into actually having your life be a little different than the ordinary. Because I felt like I was embracing extremely wonderful ideas, but every day I got up and went to work and came home from work and there was really no discernible difference. So I was quite distressed by the gap between my ideals and my expression of my life. And so I started reading about saints. I went to the section at East West Bookshop called Saints or something like that, and I just started reading from one end to the other. I read the epics of India. I read about Indian saints. I read about Western saints. I just read about people who had actually changed their lives because of their spiritual aspiration, because that was the issue for me. But most of their lives were very difficult for me to embrace. St. Francis walked out of his house and lived barefoot in the snow. Well, I lived in San Francisco and there was no snow. Plus, I didn't really feel like walking out onto Geary Avenue where I lived in bare feet looking for lepers. It just didn't, go anywhere. You know, Milarepa lived for years in obscurity in a cave in the Himalayas, and that one was not an option. St. Teresa of Avila, who was fabulous, she was a Catholic nun. I was a Jew. That was going to be a really tough one to follow through. I just was really getting quite alarmed. And I was getting alarmed, actually, in a way that's really quite related to our topic, which is, how do I go forward? How can I even tell what's forward? You know, to just kind of run away from the world didn't exactly seem like an option. And I didn't feel drawn to do it, and I wasn't sure it would really help anything. It just was a state of total confusion. God must have heard the prayer, although the prayer must have been such a jumble, he definitely had to listen by intuition than by actual hearing the words, because I was introduced to Swami Kriyananda. who at that time, he's an American man, I guess you say was an American man, and he was living and teaching in San Francisco at the time. I was actually by then living right here in Palo Alto, and he came and spoke at Stanford University at one of the fraternity houses of all things. It was the 60s, and somebody must have thought it would be a lark to invite a Swami, so they had this big tent behind the Beta Chi house at Stanford, which was well known as a party fraternity at that point, but I'm always grateful to them. Whatever obscure force motivated them to invite him to speak there, even more oddly, whatever motivated him to accept. But that's where I first saw him. And it was an extremely interesting meeting. I mean, utterly life-changing in about the first 15 seconds. The whole rest of my life has been based on that. Because he was, I could feel that his spirituality was utterly grounded. It wasn't just ideas. It wasn't just intellectual. It was somehow it was in his bone marrow. It was exactly who he was, and it was both feet on the ground and consciousness in the infinite, all at the same time. And it was just what I was looking for. I wouldn't have even been able to describe it. And I wasn't a follower of Yogananda's teachings, which is what his path was. None of that. I had Autobiography of a Yogi, but I'd never read it. Or differently, I'd read a few pages of it, and I didn't like it. I had no hint that it would be so important in my life. I just put it away. I didn't like it. And I met Swami Kriyananda, and I could feel, well, I'll use the words we're using for tonight. I could feel he was my roadmap. I could feel that he had accomplished what I was trying to accomplish and in some way that was going to translate for me. And at that time, he was just starting the communities of Ananda, just starting the first community, which was Ananda Village, which is still going. It's about 1,000 acres and about 300 people. Lives up north of Sacramento near Grass Valley. I became a founding member of that community. I wasn't the first to arrive, but I was in the first wave. And even that aspect of it, which is like, this is not about, well, although that, I suppose that might have seemed radical at the time to leave what I was doing and go live on, in this, what was very scarcely more than bare land with this idea. It, to me, it seemed just like such the most natural thing in the world to do. It was only slowly that I began to perceive it as others might have perceived it. I was so happy to have something actual to do to change my life, that it never crossed my mind that there might be something even slightly insecure about going to live in a little tiny trailer on this bare piece of land up in the mountains with about 30 other people who are just like me. It was the 60s, bear in mind, and we reasoned a little differently in those days. But what he presented was a state of happiness, is the way I would call it. What he also presented to me was a state of freedom. And I didn't have a very sophisticated understanding of why, but apparently I had the past life conditioning and the karmic readiness to be able to recognize it when I saw it, even though I didn't know what it really even was. As I've written and said many times to others, I saw him, and the first thing I saw, I thought when I saw him before he even spoke, was he has what I want. And I would have described it later, and I did, as both happiness and freedom. And by freedom, I didn't mean the freedom to indulge myself. It was the freedom of self-mastery, because that's really the only freedom there is. We think freedom is the ability to do whatever you want to do. And then that's what young people sort of toss at older people. I realized at a certain point that my parents, who I roundly criticized for being so unspontaneous and so stodgy in their way of doing things, were not that way until we were born, the children. And then the children have the audacity and the ingratitude to blame the parents for being so practical when they were never practical until they had to take care of us. Very annoying. I got that fairly early, you know, and I realized it wasn't really their fault, it was our fault. But let me think where I was with that just a moment. And older people are always criticizing young people by saying, when you have responsibilities, you'll see. And, you know, it's a mantra of youth, to be free, to be free, to free to follow my desires wherever they may go. Young people say that without embarrassment. If you've been a yogi for as long as I have, it's an embarrassing thing when people say that, but it's not embarrassing to them. You know, to follow your desires is like the antithesis of what you're trying to accomplish as a devotee. You're trying to gain mastery over them. Now, that sounds extremely unattractive to people who are trying to fulfill them. But what real freedom is to have mastery, or at least some mastery, over your own impulses so that you may choose how you express yourself instead of being compelled. And that's really the one of the keys. We're going to start making a roadmap here. Which is, it's not really what you do, because sometimes your karma requires certain actions. And the age that we live in now is not an age of extreme external renunciation. This gentleman who's wearing the same color I am asked me why I'm wearing this color, which I always wear, since the last 4 years, because this is an initiation color for me. I've taken a certain vow of renunciation. And so I always, in fact, my friend here is sitting here also dressed in blue for the same reason. You'll see some of us wandering around. This is a renunciate order that Swami Kriyananda initiated. He reformed the Sannyas order of India, in which they had been wearing orange, and transferred it over. He decided that blue was the color, just to give you just a little picture of that. Orange is the color of burning up. It's the color of fire. And the tradition of renunciation until now has always been to focus on what you're giving up. You know, you don't have a family, you don't have sexuality in your life, you don't have material goods, you don't have free will, you're under obedience to someone, you don't have this, you don't have that. The orange color of the Swamis and the reddish color of the Buddhists, that's the color of fire that burns things up. Swamiji felt, in this age where we're moving into a different reality, instead of focusing on what we're giving up, we should focus on where we're going. And this is the color of Christ consciousness. This is the color of the spiritual eye. This is the color of the infinite sky. So by wearing the blue color, what we're paying attention to is what we're going to become. And when we follow a path of renunciation based on where we're going, the emphasis is always on what you're adding into your life instead of what you're leaving out of your life. It's a completely different orientation, where the planet is in a new age. It's self-evident if you look around. They don't have to persuade you. There's enormous, interesting support for that. There's a book called The Yugas, which is written by a friend of mine named Joseph Selby. David Steinmetz, together they wrote it. It's Y-U-G-A-S, The Yugas. Fascinating book about planetary ages. But we're in a new age at this time, and one of the qualities of this new age is that we're working more with the energy of things than the form. So whereas in the past, it was all about the form. You wanted to be a serious spiritual person. You went to this monastery. You went to the Himalayas. You went to that hermitage. You went to this ashram. There was no serious possibility. I mean, there was some, of course, but not a serious possibility of really integrating a complete spiritual path with what people would think of as ordinary life. But Yogananda came to bring another reality, and one of the reasons that Ananda has always been community-oriented is that we're talking about bringing spirit into every aspect of life, and this is what people intuitively want these days. I mean, the monasteries, such as they are, they're emptying out. You know, religious orders that have been going on for centuries, they just don't have new converts. And you have a few older people and then a few young ones, but the whole vitality of it is draining away. But simultaneously, people are wanting to be more spiritual. So it isn't really a lack of spiritual aspiration. It's a complete shifting of the form. But one of the factors that we have to realize, and this is where I was starting to say a few moments ago, what we're really looking for is freedom. And whereas some people see a step of formal renunciation as a limiting of options, if the individual understands it in the right spirit, actually you're expanding your options because you're no longer dissipating your energy in ways that don't bring you what you really want in life. I was speaking earlier because I was asked about this. I wasn't a fancy person, but I always really liked my wardrobe. I particularly liked color. I would wake up every morning and I would think, what color do I want to be today? And if I had on the wrong color, I'd have to change clothes. Before I'd come to do a lecture, I would always think about what color I was going to wear, you know, what would be the right mood for the talk. And I would think about the audience and wanting to wear something that would be nice for them. And I enjoyed shopping and had a very nice wardrobe. And when Swami Kriyananda started this and mentioned that we would always be dressed in blue, I have to admit it was not that immediate for me. I mean, to say that, it took me about 3 days, so it wasn't a really long time. But still, I had to say, oh, like that. But once you choose an expanded reality for reasons that you yourself understand, that are not imposed upon you, you just have this certain sense of freedom, you know. And I rarely get bored. I miss being able to just wander around Nordstrom and look at pretty things, but that's about all. It rarely bothers me. And there is, on the other hand, this, and all the women in the room understand this, this incredible freedom. Whoa, there's nothing in my closet. You know, there's no choices to make anymore. There's just no, this is it, what does it matter? And I've observed something interesting from my 87-year-old aunt, just before she passed away. I mean, she was old. She wasn't elderly, she was old. There's no other word for it. And she was very old. But I realized that, you know, really, how do I want to say it? Really unfair things happen to women as they age. Men tend not to change as much as women do. But I realize that the older a person gets, the more they become just their eyes. And even though my aunt was all wrinkled up around it, she had these beady little bright eyes. She was very sharp and very with it. Just these beady little bright eyes that were so dynamic that I realized whenever I related to her or dealt with her in any way, all I ever dealt with was those eyes. And what I realized is that the eyes, being the window to the soul, are the only part of us that we have absolute control over. Because they really do speak of how we lived and who we have become. So it kind of takes that whole question of, especially of feminine beauty and feminine aging, and just puts it in a completely different reality in a very profound way. And if we don't like what we see, then we need to change who we are. Now, coming back to the roadmap idea, which is where I was starting. But we have to understand on the spiritual path, spiritually speaking, that even though we may have an idea in our mind that the spiritual path is defined by certain kind of behaviors, and even granted that certain kinds of behaviors are going to be self-evidently beneficial, the human being is made in a certain way. And we can assert that, you know, I'm a person who can just drink all day, every day, and it doesn't really affect me. I'm a person who can live on coffee and Danish pastry, and it won't really affect me. It's just not true. The physical body has a certain reality, and the spiritual self has a certain reality. And the consequences of our own actions may take a little while to catch up with us, but catch up with us they will. I remember back in the early 70s when some young people were having a satsang, a gathering with Swami Kriyananda, who represented a very traditional lineage, although he was interpreting it in a rather innovative way. But still, he was orthodox in his spiritual understanding. And they asked him, what did he think about the sexual revolution? And the natural orthodox answer would have been, not much. But his answer was, well, he said, overall, I think it's a good thing. Which was a rather surprising answer and one that they quite duly noted down and liked. But then he went on to say, he said, because people are making experience the criteria for their beliefs. And he said, and if you are honest in evaluating your experience, all experience will lead to the same conclusions. Because true values are not about dogmatism. True values do not belong to any particular church or ideology or ism. True values are the way we're made. Ananda Village and Ananda in general has been a really interesting learning experiment for this reason. Our communities are now 40 years old. Ananda Village was started actually in 1968. So we're really pushing. We've been there quite a long time now. And that's, you know, two full generations. And you begin to see, because a lot of us have all been together for a long time and have seen a lot of people come and go, that certain kinds of behavior bring certain kinds of results. It's a very small laboratory. And self-concerned, self-centered behavior tends to result in an unhappy life. And generous, serviceful, deliberately joyful behavior tends to result in a very happy life. And it's been a small enough little microcosm of the universe to be able to just watch the consequence of certain attitudes. And because I've more or less been standing in one place the whole time, I've seen a lot of people move around me. And even consequences that take 15 or 20 years to act themselves out, I'm able to watch them act themselves out. And rarely does the result surprise me anymore. And when we make experience the criteria of our behavior, we begin to understand that this one thing works and something else doesn't. So the first principle, really, of spiritual life is you really have to pay attention with a great deal of self-honesty to your actual experience. And I will just back up even one and say the first principle of spiritual life is self-honesty. Because you'll never get anywhere until you're honest with yourself. And that self-honesty has two dimensions. One is to be able to see your errors, and the other is not to identify yourself with your mistakes. And to be able to just see the perspective of your reality exactly as it is. Interestingly, Yogananda defines the word humility as self-honesty. Because if you actually see yourself as you are, then humility is the natural side effect of that. Now, to be honest is to know that you're good at some things and you're bad at others, and that sometimes your good intentions bear good fruit and sometimes your good intentions just go wildly haywire and nothing that you want to have happen will really happen. But if a person can't honestly stand back and take real objective responsibility for the state of one's life and the result of one's own actions, it's very, very difficult to advance spiritually. Because the antithesis of self-honesty is usually to blame others, to become a victim. And one of the premises of the spiritual path is that, well, I'll use the word karma, but another way to say it is, you know, there's a certain fairness to life. And until we're able to be self-honest enough to understand that everything that happens is the karmic law, which is cause and effect, then it's very difficult to make spiritual progress because you're never going to take responsibility for what happens. It's always going to be someone else's fault. And the whole essence of the spiritual path is self-transformation. And it's not so easy, but just to be able to stand in the reality of what is, and sometimes the reality of what is you know what? This is not really my fault. It's not, self-honesty is not self-abnegation. Self-honesty is not to completely undervalue yourself. It's to know that sometimes I'm right and sometimes I'm wrong, and that there's a cause and effect relationship that is always acting itself out in this world. The difficulty with always being able to see it, cause and effect being another word for karma, is that sometimes it takes karma a long while to show itself. It may even take incarnations to show itself. But when it finally catches up to you, it's always catching up to you for a good reason. And it doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It just means it's catching up to you for a good reason. And you see people who seem terrifically fortunate and nothing difficult ever happens to them. And you don't see all the lifetimes in which they built up all that momentum in order to have that experience. Or you see someone who seems to always be struggling against hard times and you don't realize perhaps what strength they're building, what karmic debts they're paying off. You know, all of us make mistakes, and sometimes those mistakes catch up with you. I was just driving down the road today, and I was just remembering some terribly irresponsible things I did when I was in college, which was only 1 year. I'd completely forgotten. I had taken on certain responsibilities, and when I didn't fulfill them, I hid from the people who were trying to find me to hold me accountable. I mean, I'd forgotten completely about that whole incident in my life. And I realized, you know, well, that set in motion a certain quality of energy. As one of my friends described it, karma is like a circle. And when you put an energy out, it's like half the circle, but it won't be done until that circle finishes. And even if we think ourselves small, once in my life when I was 18, I was somewhere and there was something that I wanted that didn't belong to me, and I took it. It was a moderate value. I didn't steal it from a store, I stole it from a place. I was sort of mad at the people who ran the place, and I somehow felt justified in taking it. Very uncharacteristic of me. I'm extremely honest, and I'll say I was under the influence of bad companions, but I have to take responsibility also. But I was under the influence of bad companions. That made me do something uncharacteristic. About 20 years later, I was given something that was extremely precious to me, very precious to me. And I lived in a little trailer at Ananda Village, a place that was very safe. I had to leave town, and I had the impulse. It was a small item. I had the impulse to take it with me. And then out of sort of a false sense of renunciation, I said, no, I don't need to have it with me. I'll just leave it in my trailer. Somebody came into my trailer and stole it from me. And that's all they took. But it was stolen because the person went around and stole a few things from other places. It wasn't of value to anyone else. It was more sentimental. But as soon as that was taken from me, I felt in my heart that it was the karmic balance for what I'd stolen. Isn't that interesting? And I actually spoke to Swami Kriyananda later, and I said, I think that was taken from me because I deliberately and consciously stole something once in my life. But it was half an energy. So later on, when something was really important to me, it was going to be taken from me. So I think the first and most important principle on the spiritual path is to realize that everything you see is interrelated. That we can't take, I mean, just think about it. Look at this tapestry that's right here. Well, is this painted or is this woven? Let's pretend it's woven. Yeah, it's woven. It's machine woven, but it's woven. Okay. It's all threads, isn't it? It just goes, you know, all along. It's not woven in the way that I really want to show you, though, because the threads start over again. But the idea being that the thread goes all the way across, doesn't it? And all the way down. And if you tried to just cut this thing out right here, where would you say it starts? No, so this is your incarnation, and you've drawn a little square right here. This is my incarnation. But where did it start? How far away did it start? Where is it going? What is the actual end of what you're experiencing? And we're always just taking some little tiny incident. This is so unfair. My boss is so unkind to me. I do such good work, and he just doesn't appreciate me, we say, as if we could just pull that little piece out. You know, or why is it that that he can eat anything he wants and he never gains any weight, and I just have one cookie and I have 2 pounds on my body? You know, just he never exercises, and you just have all these different ways of. I remember when I was a child or when I was a teenager, curly hair was not in fashion. And it was such a difficult thing to have curly hair. And I would sleep on these huge rollers, you know, at night, and it was just impossible. And then I lived in Southern California at the time, and it was often foggy in the morning. And by the time I walked, you know, the 4 blocks from my house to the school, it was all just corkscrewed again like that. You know, just... But all of this suffering, you know, that goes on, it was just trivial by comparison, but... I often would think about how we look to Swami Kriyananda, and just from his perspective of freedom and transcendence of all of this, and realize that, you know, my concern about my curly hair and the fog, you know, everything about my life looked like that to him. Because, you see, we're compelled by these forces that we've set in motion. And the more we rebel against them, and the more we're not self-honest enough to see that God is really trying to teach me something, or if you're not comfortable with God, that just your own higher self is trying to teach you something, that life itself is trying to bring you to a deeper understanding. But instead of understanding, I think I'll just have a hissy fit about it. My friend's little boy was about 4, and he was very frustrated about being a child. He didn't really like being a child very much. And he would have temper tantrums a lot, just in sheer frustration. And she was a solid, calm mom. And when her boy would, after he reached a certain age, when he'd have these temper tantrums, she would just pick him up and she would put him in his room. And she would shut the door and she would put the latch on, and he could just stay in his room until he was done. And then she heard him in there just sort of screaming and kicking the floor a little bit. And then it got quiet. She opened the door and very sweetly just said, "Honey, are you done?" And he looked up at her and he said, "Not quite, Mommy." So she shut the door again. And then he screamed and banged around for a while. And I often feel that our Divine Mother, which is a very sweet way to think about God, is our Divine Mother. I want this. I want this man in my life. I want this woman in my life. I want to look like this. I want to live longer than my body is going to last. I want to be young again. I want to be rich. I want to be a different race, a different country, whatever it might be. And we have a fit about it. And instead of recognizing that whatever we have been given is exactly what we ourselves have created from all this tapestry that we've been weaving for a really long time, and instead of trying to just make those threads go where they're trying to go as beautifully as we can make them, we just lock ourselves in our room and cry and beat the floor. And it's not as if God is indifferent. But what can he do? What can she do? She can't cut the piece of your life out and just make it completely separate from everything that's gone before. I mean, I often think of it just, there's not one aspect of the life you're living now that you can actually separate from everything. I mean, just, I'm looking at your pink and white t-shirt, you know. Where did the t-shirt come from? Why did you buy it? Why did you happen to be in that store? What caused you to choose that color? You know, is this something that your mother taught you was nice? Is this something you made up for yourself? Do your friends like it? Whoever made such a t-shirt in the first place? Was it influenced by the Grateful Dead? You know, where did Jerry Garcia's parents meet? You know? And why did tie-dye become associated with, just like, where do you stop? Where do you stop? Where do you start? You see, everything is interrelated to everything else. And when we're honest enough to realize that we're just living in this this sea of moving energy, and that if we just start screaming at the river to stop, we can, and people do. They start weeping, and they never stop. Maybe they can dry their tears, but inwardly, they never stop. And unfortunately, you see, it has no effect on reality. It has a profound effect on our individual experience, but has no effect whatsoever on the tapestry, because we are part of this greater reality, and that's part of the self-honesty and the karmic law that we need to understand, is that we are part of this greater reality. And my freedom is not to be able to just separate myself out from that which I am integrally related to. My freedom is in my ability to master my response. I remember one day I was, this is completely irrelevant, but you'll see in just a second it relates to it. There's a country western song. This is one of those, you know, great country western titles. I've got tears in my ears from lying on my back, crying my eyes out over you. Well, I was feeling distressed about something. In my younger years, I was far more emotionally volatile than I am now, thank God. And not that I was, but that I'm not. And I was upset about something, and I was more inclined to cry. And I just was at home, and I sort of stretched out on my back. That's where the tears in my ears began to come to me. And I was going to just cry like women are inclined to do. And I was sort of there, and I was, you know, just warming up. And I thought to myself, you know, it's so tiring to cry. If I lie here and cry, I'm just going to be exhausted all afternoon, and the whole day is just going to be lost. And I'm not going to spend the rest of my life lying here crying, because sooner or later I'll be finished and I'll just have to get up. As one of my friends said, it's really not that easy to lie down and die. Even though you try sometimes, you get hungry, you get bored, you get curious as to what that noise is outside the door. You know, things happen. So I knew sooner or later I would get up, and I thought, just why exhaust myself? And then so I just stood up. I was so proud of myself. Was a real turning point in my life. It was like, oh, I have a choice. I have a choice. Actions have consequences, and if I don't enjoy the consequences, I don't have to go there. The experience was still difficult. It wasn't like anything had changed about the experience. It was that my perspective on my experience has changed. Self-honesty, you see, is also about perspective. Self-honesty is saying, I'm upset, you know, it's not going to make any difference. I'm upset because maybe I was genuinely mistreated, or maybe I just think I'm upset, whatever it might be. But perspective is everything. If you're looking at your life experience like this, if you've got a black spot in your life, and God knows there's a lot of black spots in life. People die young, people that you love go away, someone that is very dear to you does not return your affection. Your boss is, in fact, a creep. I mean, these things really do happen. So we stand here like this, you know, and what we're seeing is actually happening. It's not like it's not there. And you can't get rid of it by saying, oh, it's a beautiful white spot. It's just exactly, you know, really what I wanted. That doesn't work for me. That's never worked for me. I'm too honest. If I'm not telling the truth, I know it. You know, this is not what I wanted. I loathe this. But the difference is, you see, where are you standing in relation to it? And even more, how much of life do you have around it? So it isn't so much that this is not what it appears to be. Because, you know, there's a kind of Pollyanna spirituality, which I've just never been very good at. I'm except for that notable time when I stole that thing, I'm tremendously honest. And just too frank, I'm not good at saying everything is fine when it's not. As my husband says to me, sometimes you could try not to have everything you think show on your face. Oh, well, that's an idea. So that everyone knows everything you think. Poor man, imagine. Finish that sentence, being married to me. Yes. Okay. He's been very good sport about it. It's been more than 30 years. He's gotten used to it. He's a great fellow. He's a fabulous man. But it depends on how much else you have in your life, you see. And so that's part of the roadmap of the spiritual path, which is what is real? Is only this moment and this experience the only reality, or is this all part of a bigger web? And if I'm going to be fine eventually, Why waste all that time suffering? You know, if I lie on the bed and cry, by the time I'm finished, I'll just be so exhausted, and then eventually I'm just going to have to recover. When I, just before I met Swami Kriyananda, I was having a super, super existential crisis. And I think in my past lives, I've solved my existential crisis by just actually literally losing my mind, just going. I mean, mental disease, there's another word I'm trying to think of, but you know, being off mentally, just not able to cope in normal, mental illness, of course, that's the obvious word. It's familiar to me. It doesn't sort of, I'm not a psychiatrist, I've never been interested in working with that population, but somehow when I see it, it looks familiar. This is reincarnational, you know, in the course of our many lifetimes, Yogananda said we do everything. That's hard to believe, isn't it? Because we have to find out for ourselves whether or not it's really going to make us happy. Coming back to this idea of renunciation, you can't renounce something if you think it's going to make you happy. You might restrain yourself from doing it, but you'll always be wanting it underneath, and sooner or later your desire in this life or another will just take you back to it. As Gandhi put it, you should never renounce a pleasure until you've replaced it with a higher pleasure, so that it doesn't even feel like renunciation. It may feel a little bit like discipline, but it doesn't feel like deprivation. You know, when I had to give away all my clothes, there was a feeling of, oh, I've really enjoyed all these things. And even now when I see them walking around on other people, which I do a great deal, my first thought always is, oh, that's pretty. And then I'll realize, huh, that used to be mine. I guess that's why I like it. You know, that's why it strikes me as being particularly attractive. But it took discipline, a little bit of discipline, not much. But I don't feel deprived. If you feel deprived, it's a little dangerous. You have to be careful about that. Let's see, what I was saying was... it was about mental illness. I was having a really big existential crisis. I didn't really realize it till I was out of it. Because I remember standing and looking out the window of the apartment I was living at 4th and Geary up in San Francisco, looking out the window thinking, you know, when a person feels as desperate as I did for meaning in life, everything externally was fine. But I was old enough to be a grown-up, and I'd just been waiting to be a grown-up, thinking that it would change. And now I was close enough to being a grown-up, and it was doing enough grown-up things, and it still felt as undirected and pointless as it had felt when I was smaller. This very quiet sense of desperation began to grow in me, and I thought, well, I could feel a person in my condition becomes a drug addict, which is something that people do just out of a state of complete despair. They become a suicide. Or they just have a nervous breakdown, which is kind of somewhere in between. And I seriously just went through those options and realized, oh, drug addiction, it's so tiring, and in the end you just have to go through rehab and a whole incarnation is gone. I instinctively knew that suicide wasn't going to take me anywhere. Later I learned the metaphysics of it, but I knew it just, the problem with it is it wouldn't work. I didn't really know about reincarnation, but I could just tell it was not going to solve the problem. And a mental breakdown was the most attractive option, but it had the same drawback that lying on my bed crying did. I could just see it. In the end, I would go to the hospital, it would be extremely disruptive, and then eventually I would pull myself together, and then I would come out, and I would be standing at this window, looking out the window, wondering what to do with my life, that it was all just going to go in a big circle. And then I was rescued by Swami Kriyananda, which is I was rescued by the fact, oh, I can change my consciousness. And that's really what I'm trying to do here. Because the compulsion I feel, the entrapment I feel, the extraordinary squished into a tiny box that I feel, it's all my state of consciousness. And when I saw Kriyananda walk into that room, I realized, wow, this man has a different consciousness. And his consciousness was so different and yet so connected to mine. You know, his went way farther than mine did, but it also came all the way to where mine was. And so therefore that meant there was a road. There was a road between us. Because if he could come to me, that meant I could go to him. I mean, all of this was like split-second intuitions. And what I saw in him was that he did not have edges. And what creates our edges is this word ego, which, of course, is a bad word spiritually, but there's a better understanding of it. And I'm going to actually talk about Patanjali. Fantastic. Yogananda described ego as, I'll use the word soul, which is your individual, the part of you that is infinite. Soul identified, and this is the key word, this is the Patanjali word, soul identified with the body. And body means the material world. Material world, the ephemeral world. And there's nothing, you know, it's here. We have to live with it. But our true nature is infinite. And we all sort of know that somehow. We all sort of know that we're more than what's going on here, which is why you can lie on your bed and start to cry and then think, no, I just don't think I'll do this. When we feel unhappy, there's a sense of wholehearted rebellion against that. If we really felt we were meant to be unhappy, we would not rebel against it. The mere fact that we rebel against it is because our soul knows this is not who I really am. Even age, sickness, all of it, we push against it because a part of us knows that freedom is my true nature, bliss is my true nature. But the soul becomes identified with this limited experience, which you can define as the body. It's very interesting when you really start thinking about this. Now, there's not only a physical body, there's also an astral and a causal body, which is to say merely killing this body will not free you because you're identified with your subsequent bodies too. But if you think about it, everything that limits you, why do you feel lonely? Because we think that I'm this one body. And if I'm all by myself somewhere and nobody is with me, I think I'm alone, don't I? We identify with this body and it begins to age or it becomes ill or it even begins to die. Or someone we love goes far away. We raise our children with so much love and care and then they marry somebody in China and they go and live in China. Or we are the wrong gender or the wrong race or we just don't look like what we're supposed to look like, what we think we're supposed to look like. We just have all these things. But it's all identified with the body. And ego is the limitation imposed on our infinite self because we've identified with this one reality. Now it's an extremely subtle and very, very interesting thought. Because if you think about it in a progressive way, we'll think of it like this. Let's think about prejudice. Let's think about bigotry. A few decades ago in the South, some white people, identified so strongly with being white that the thought of a person of dark skin, you know, riding on the same bus, using the same bathroom, swimming in the same beach, it's just like that person in that dark skin was so not me that they were hysterical about the fact of those two forces coming in together because that soul had identified so deeply with that particular body that they couldn't identify with their shared humanity. Now, that's an extreme example, isn't it? But someone can identify with their job, the job that they do, that where this body and this mind have gone to this job and identified so deeply with what this body does at work that when they lose that job, they lose their equanimity completely, right? A person can identify with the body so deeply that they're driven, let's say, by the sexual impulse, just so completely that they can't be faithful to their partner and they can't live without you become sex addicts or whatever it is that people become because the infinite soul has become so identified with the body. And all what happens, the nature of the body, you see, is that it's ephemeral and it's in a state of constant change. I was mentioning you raise your children. I remember my mother, who was a dear woman. What was the happiest time of your life? I asked her. Oh, when the children were small. You know, and she loved being a mother, and she always was a little sorry, you know, that we didn't stay small forever. My mother-in-law, 3 children. She was not a sentimental person. She didn't keep a lot around, but she had one picture of each of her children, big pictures like this on the mantelpiece when they were about 8 years old. You know, my husband was 50, 55, and still here's the picture. You know, that was the part that held her, but life is always changing. But identified as she was with her body, she identified with the fruit of her own womb, the children that she'd raised. And, you know, she loved me, but not like she loved her son. And she identified with the values that she had tried to inculcate in them. And when my husband and I became part of Ananda, if you come to our temple on Sunday mornings, we have a ritual service, and I dress pretty much like this, a slight variation on this theme, extremely slight. You would not notice, but I would notice, okay? And, you know, it's a temple. We have an altar with our masters on the altar, and it's a temple, and we call ourselves light bearers, but sometimes we just call ourselves ministers. One of my friends said, oh, your parents must be so proud of you to be a minister. I said, my family is Jewish. One of our gurus is Jesus. His picture's on the wall. Start there. That's a big strike against us. And, you know, and there's no place in what my parents identified with for what I was doing. I mean, we struck a happy harmony because, as I pointed out to them, it's not going to have any effect on me, and it's just going to ruin our relationship. So just be nice. That's just the way to be. So they accepted it. But you see, if they had not identified so much with that one body, think what might have been possible. You know, they could have identified as easily with the world I was in. And everybody that you admire, and every time you have a happy experience, you realize is because their self-identity is expansive enough. Aren't those the people that you love the most? The people who all of a sudden, whatever's going on with you is going on with them. You know, it's like, oh yeah, we have to figure out how we're going to move on the weekend. You know, we have to figure out how we're going to get a new car. And it was your new car, but they've just identified with you. I don't mean in an intrusive way, but just an automatic expansiveness. And the more we allow ourselves, well, above all, to identify with our true nature, which is the soul, but the more we expand our sense of identity, the more free we are, the less compelled we are, because the more all this world is our own. One of the factors that Patanjali emphasizes with enormous force is just a simple fact. There's no delusion except in your own consciousness that you have identified with limitation. You've identified with your faults. You've identified with your physical body. You've identified with the implications of that. You've identified with your own karma. Whereas it's all just a question. It's not that that's not happening. It's just a question of how much of a bigger world we build around it. Swami Kriyananda used to say that he never identified with Swami Kriyananda. He considered Swami Kriyananda to be an event for which he was responsible. I always like that. I've put on many big events. When you put on a big event, you have to be really involved. You can't just sort of stand back and think somebody else is going to do it. You have to put a lot of energy into making it come out right. But you don't actually think that that's yourself. It's just an event for which you're responsible. That's the balancing factor of spiritual life. If it's just an event, you want it to come out well, and there's lots of good reasons why you need for it to, but it never defines you. So even when death comes, which is really the end of all of this, you know, I've had the opportunity. When Swami Kriyananda died, he was in Italy, and many of us flew over to Italy. You know, it was 11 o'clock at night here when he died at 8 in the morning there, and many of us went to Italy, and his body had been laid out in a casket, and for several days when we were there, it was just there. There's a lot of spiritual energy coming from such a great soul. So even though cremation is common, you don't burn the body of a great soul. You save the body and bury it, because where it's buried has power. But it was so clear that he wasn't in that body. I mean, that he never had been. And this is the image that came to me, and it's a big image, but it's relevant for here. I have done a little bit of scuba diving in my life, not a huge amount, but enough to know what that looks like. And if you've ever done it, the ocean is like this, and you can only see a little way into the ocean. Some oceans you can see in more with a snorkel mask and so on, but you really can't see what's really down there. And the only way you can find out is if you can go with a tank, and then you start going down. And then you realize, just to a stunning extent, how enormous the ocean is. And when you're in there, you realize the ocean is, you know, literally thousands and thousands of miles in all directions. It's just so huge. And huge universes are going on down there that you have no idea are happening from the surface. And then you come up again, and as soon as you get above the waterline, then you're just back in this universe, and that universe is gone. Well, I began to appreciate that Swami Kriyananda had identified with the entire ocean. And on the surface, there was this little wave that was called Kriyananda. And that because he was the whole ocean, he moved that little wave. And, you know, and it did all the little things that the Kriyananda wave had to do. And in his case, was an enormously busy, active life like this. But when his spirit withdrew from that wave, this was about how much happened from his point of view. From our point of view, you know, quite a lot happened. It was a really big event from us because we were much more deeply identified with that wave than he was. For him, it's just the little wave just stopped like that. The heart stopped, the breath stopped, just so light like that. Now, if we can just go that direction, you know, spiritual path is directional. If we just go that direction, oh, yes, I have to do this job. I have this passionate work I have to do. I have these books I have to write. You can throw yourself into it, and you should, with all the energy you have. I have these children to raise. I have this, you know, spouse to find and to marry and this home to make. You know, you can have profound and powerful things that you do because you are responsible for the wave. But always recognize that the ocean is my true home. And I'm living this life while I have to live it. And so when the energy of that wave is done, it just closes, goes back into the hole. And that's a surprisingly practical everyday solution. You're about to lie down on your bed and weep. Or if you're a man, maybe you're about to put your fist through the wall, whatever it might be, however it goes for you. Or be a woman putting your fist through the wall, whatever. And you just think for a minute, oh, this is just the wave, you know. When it's over, it'll just go and I'll be going back to the sea. From the perspective of the ocean, how much does this matter? I have to figure out what the proper response is. I have to be self-honest enough about my own karma. But if I can be less ego-identified, and that doesn't mean less individual or less powerful. That's why you have to understand this properly. In fact, the more the soul identifies with the infinite, the more power it has. That was the secret of Swami Kriyananda's extraordinary creative potential, is that he just never identified with anything except the ocean. And so his wave was always drawing on the whole ocean. Whereas if you identify with just the little wave, you don't have any. Just think how hard a wave has to work if it forgets that it's part of the ocean. Just flailing around there. It's sort of silly when you think about it, but if you feel it coming all the way, or another way to think of it is if you're the leaf of the tree, just thinking that you're the only thing happening, when in fact you have the whole entire tree to draw from, and then you can be a fabulous little leaf, you know, just really fabulous, but you know where it comes from. Okay, do we have any questions or thoughts or comments about any of this? Yes. What is your name?
My name is Ann.
Ann? Yes. Okay, nice to meet you.
I would like to know if it's better to worship one master or the other, for example, Jesus Christ or Swami Kshananda or the same path, or is it all one, or do you have like there's more light or more high consciousness in one master or the other?
All paths, all true paths lead to the same mountaintop.
Okay.
Not all people who teach actually have gotten all the way to the mountaintop. Some of them are wandering around in the valley, and some of them are heading downhill. So ultimately, everything resolves into the same infinite eternity. If it didn't, none of them would be true. I mean, there can't be more than one absolute. But it's very hard to get to the top of the mountain by all paths. If you go a little bit this way, and then you run over here and go a little bit this way, and then you run over here and go a little bit this way, you end up never really progressing very far, because they often require different things of you, different vibrations, different teachings. If you think of it another way, if you think of like a big wheel and truth being in the center, if you're north of center, you have to go south to get to the center. If you're south of center, you have to go north. So true teachings can even contradict each other, because they are designed for different temperaments. And you'll often find, because the disciples don't understand their own master's teachings, that they contradict each other. And now that's one aspect of it. You can often get spiritual indigestion. But on a more subtle level, the real power to advance spiritually is a matter of attunement with the consciousness of one who has achieved what you're trying to achieve. That's the guru-disciple relationship. And that's a very subtle bond. And if eventually on your spiritual path, you have to find one way and go deep into it, because what's required of you requires that kind of subtle concentration. And even the impulse to say, well, I'll do this one for a while, then I'll do this one for a while, and then this one looks interesting to me and I like this. Often, for one, from our perspective, we have no idea what we're even seeing. We don't really know. It's very hard to objectify yourself. It's hard to know what it is that I really need. And if I'm always allowing my impulses to dictate, it's almost impossible. It is impossible, I'll be frank. It's impossible to actually truly become free. The difference between a committed relationship and dating lots of people, it's pretty much exactly the same. You learn to love when you are committed to learning to love, because often what drives you away is the very thing you have to overcome. However, you shouldn't make a commitment until you feel it. You shouldn't marry until you feel that you're with someone at least whose character you believe in, that you know has the values that you need. So you shop for a while. But if you're in a true teaching with a truly elevated path, even if it's not your final home, you will learn from it, and then the clarity of mind that you gain will take you where you need to go next. But if you don't commit yourself, you'll never change. And if you never change, you'll never know. When I actually came to Ananda, I wasn't certain of where my path was. I had loyalty to another path also. And I sort of said, but this is true, what I'm following. And if I follow it with my whole... The reason I don't know is because my intuition is clouded. And if I hold back, waiting for an intuitive answer, my intuition will never clear, because I'm not doing anything to clear it. If I commit myself and practice what I know to be a true path, I will advance spiritually. And as I advance, my intuition will become clear, and then I'll know. Which is exactly what happened about a year into my commitment. I woke up one morning and said, of course this is where I belong. What could I have been thinking? It was just as clear as day, but it wasn't earlier. And it wouldn't have been if I hadn't committed myself. And I just said to God and Gurus, your problem, you guys figure this out. I'll do my part and you do yours. I often see people saying, well, I just don't know. So I just don't want to do everything until I know. And how are you ever going to know, you know, if you're not doing anything to make yourself any better except worry? You know, you just need to get into the game and act as if you know. I mean, look around enough so that you have reason to believe that what you're following is going to work for you. And it's very hard to gauge the consciousness of a master. I mean, not being one, you can't tell. So one of the ways you can tell the fruit of a spiritual path is look at the people who follow it, because that's who you'll become. And it's not just a question of whether you admire them. Do you like them? You know, are they? Is that somebody you want to be? I mean, I go to ashrams. I used to visit many ashrams, and I could admire some of them, but I didn't particularly like them. I didn't like their music. And I went to one place, and the chanting was just so lugubrious. You know, it was very heavy. I mean, they all seemed to really like it. I thought it was just horrible. The music is a lot of how you can tell. You know, just does it feel, do you want to be like that? And when you meet the people who are representing it, do you want to be like them? Because that's who you'll become. And often long before you know you want to be with the master, you really want to be with the disciples. They're just really attractive to you. But can we bring this to something I can respond to?
If the police, if someone does the uncooperating, what the police does is they will ask people who are there, what can you remember?
I need to be able to respond.
Some people will remember different pieces.
Yes, of course.
And then the police will put that piece together.
Okay, I can answer you from the perspective that I have, because I know you could go on for a very long time. I understand what the question you're asking. Here's the main point. There is a difference between a self-realized master and the revelation he has of infinity and the religion that develops afterwards by people of far lesser consciousness who gradually take his revelation and make it more and more comprehensible to a lower and lower state of consciousness. The difference between revelation and religion is everything. Okay? Christ was a true master, he had a true revelation. Buddhist was a true master, he had a true revelation. Moses was a true master. Judaism, Buddhism, Christianity, those people are often at war with each other. But it's not the fault of the revelation, it's that the people who come after just keep they have a lower state of awareness and they keep reinterpreting it, and they make this huge human institution, and often they become the exact opposite of what the master said. Now, in the Indian tradition, through the Bhagavad Gita, they understand that the process of life is, and this involves reincarnation and karma. These are principles that are required for this to make any sense, but if we can accept those, it's the soul's long journey of gradually increasing awareness until we have overcome ego completely and our individual consciousness identifies itself with its true nature, which is infinite. This is the revelation of a master. Jesus said, I and my Father are one. That's how he put it. Krishna puts it in different ways. Buddha put it in different ways. Moses said, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. All of these many forms are not true. There is only one reality. But it wasn't one reality, my Jewish reality against your Christian reality. It's my own consciousness has identified with the infinite reality, and in that infinity, we are all one. And according to the Indian tradition, this revelation is always then corrupted. And so then a new incarnation comes of another God-realized master. And the God-realized masters will come in this culture, in that culture, in this time, in that time. Nobody has a monopoly on them. And they appear for a certain group of people, and they have a state of revelation. And in their company, individuals themselves rise to that same state, and then gradually people make religions. And the religions all fight with each other because, quite frankly, religion is not spirituality. There was a wonderful story, a book by a man named John Tetmer. The book was called I Was a Monk. I won't tell you the whole story. He was an extremely happy priest, way up in the Vatican, having a fabulous time. He worked so hard, he had to go to Switzerland for a rest cure. While he was sitting on the balcony in Switzerland for the first time in his life doing nothing, he had a revelation. He actually experienced the power and the presence of God and the truth of Christ in his revelation. And he knew that the Catholic Church was entirely and completely wrong. And he loved being a priest, and he loved being a Catholic, and he had to resign because he realized that religion had nothing to do, even with Jesus. The Catholic Church had nothing to do with Jesus because he went into the same state as Jesus. That which I do, Jesus said. That which I do, he said, he shall do in greater things. It's just, that's the truth of it. So we do get all confused. Yeah. I wasn't saying that you are, but you see that people are fighting with each other. And so from my point of view, and this is me, the only answer to that is consciousness. People have to expand their individual consciousness so that they can see the reality, the unifying reality behind the apparent differences. But not everybody is interested or capable of perceiving that. And they are holding on to whatever they need to hold on to in order to move them forward from where they're standing. I had a radio interview with a very fundamentalist Christian man who'd been a drug addict and on the street. And he became a Christian. And so he stopped being a homeless person on the street. But his Christianity was so rigid. But it was so rigid because if he didn't grip it with both hands and have it be absolutely black and white for him, he was going to become a drug addict again. So for him, his bigoted Christianity, his narrow-minded, bigoted Christianity was forward for him. From where I was standing, it was like, you've got to be kidding. But at the same time, I didn't touch it. I supported him completely because it was right for him. And what happens is that people don't, because they don't understand reincarnation, because they don't understand the progressive increasing awareness, they don't realize that, well, he has to be like that. If he wasn't like that, he would not be more, he would be less. But when we're at a certain point where we recognize that is less, then we have to stand where we stand. And everybody has to help in right relationship to their own state of awareness. And one more point I'll add, and then I'll give this up. This world is not really meant to work. And that's something that people have to understand. This is a school, and there's many different grades in it. And this particular time on planet Earth, it's a real mixed bag here. We have a lot of, well, I'll use the simple word, demonic people living, sharing this planet with us. We have angels and we have demons. I'm not talking about Satan from hell. I'm talking about people whose consciousness, look, right now, even as we sit here, there's no problem on this planet that is not capable of solution. There is no will to solve the problems. And I consider myself to be intensely politically active because I'm trying to change consciousness. Because if we change consciousness, then people will want to solve. But until then, and even after that, this planet is designed, and this is you reading the Yugas book, this is a planet where people of many mixed consciousnesses come and hang out together, and we get to rub shoulders with people that we really would rather not rub shoulders with, but that's just, it's part of our learning. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't our karma to be here. You may have more to say to me, sir, but let me see if there's other questions first, okay? Is there anyone else who would like to ask a question? Okay.
Is it hypnotism part of consciousness?
Say again, I missed the first.
Hypnotism. Hypnotism.
People use the word hypnotism in different ways. If somebody is actually suppressing your consciousness and taking charge of your will, that's a definition of hypnotism, where somebody puts you in a trance and you're under their control. That is very, very bad for the person who's doing it, and that's very, very bad for you. You should never allow your will to be put under the control of anyone else's. So if we're talking about that, that's just not a good thing. People do hypnotherapy these days, which really amounts to progressive relaxation, visualization, kind of exploration. And I think the answer to that is what Jesus said, when how you can tell a true prophet from a false prophet is by the fruits. If that has a genuinely positive, progressive effect on your consciousness, not just in the moment, but over long term, then I would say, well, it's helpful. But you have to then make experience your criteria, and you have to be honest enough not merely to ask, did I have a good time, but did it actually change me? And I have no experience with it, but, I mean, because Yogananda spoke strongly against hypnosis, and so many people who are hypnotherapists became very concerned, and I explored it enough to understand that we're talking about two different things. Okay? I mean, and sometimes even actual trance hypnosis could be helpful if it allows you to understand something that was really hidden. But generally speaking, anybody taking possession of your consciousness, do not do that. Bad thing. Bad, bad. Because weakens you. And also then you become subject to somebody else's influence, and you know, you don't want to be influenced by someone who's not self-realized. Yes, dear. It depends. Go ahead. If, you know, past life regression is fascinating, because if you can, sometimes when you know where something is coming from, it's tremendously helpful to you. Sometimes things that, even just to think in terms of past lives, gives you a whole nother way of understanding what's going on in your life. You know, irrational fears, irrational attachments, irrational aversions, all kinds of things, chronic patterns that you don't understand. So sometimes it's very helpful to realize what you're really responding to. That it's not happening now, but it did happen then, so your feelings are true, but you're reading the situation incorrectly. Sometimes past lives really sort that out. So it entirely depends on how good the therapist is. And whether or not the experience puts you more and more in command of your own life. If the experience gradually makes you more and more dependent on the therapist, that's a bad sign. And again, the question of whether it's hypnosis or guided relaxation. And those are just things you have to just kind of test the waters if you feel interested. I think past life regression is fascinating. I've had one true dream of a past life. I mean, a real super humdinger of a dream in a past life. And I've also sorted out a few very difficult relationships through what I believe to be intuitive understanding of past lives. I've never gone to a therapist, but if there was one that I trusted, I wouldn't hesitate to recommend it. Because sometimes it's the only way you'll ever understand. You try to, you know, make your mother or your father responsible, your upbringing, it's just, you know, where did it start? You ended up, you know, it just could be so much in you. If you died in a concentration camp, you're going to be born with a certain attitude. Even if you're born into a wonderful family, you could be extremely anxious and paranoid all the time. You may need to know what came behind you, and then you meet one of the Nazi guards, and you'll go hysterical with fear, and he's just your second grade teacher. You know, but you won't go to second grade for anything in the world. I mean, all these are just like they're happening now. My revelations, the ones that I have had, it's happening now. If it's unresolved, you're carrying it in your heart. And when you meet it again, it might have been yesterday. The dream that I had, which was so real, involved my being a revolutionary, and which I know that dream was true. And, you know, certain people that I was in contact with then had, you know, arrested me, and you know, just very bad things happened, and I didn't like those people. They made me really nervous. But they were not evil anymore, and I was no longer that kind of violent revolutionary either. But the hurt that we'd imposed upon each other was still in my heart. And it was a big effort to get out of the past and live in the present. As Swami said, neither of you would ever behave that way again. That was his answer. Yes, it was true, but both of you have changed. Oh, that's a thought. Yes.
I believe in the eye seeing the windows of the soul.
Yes.
Now, if a person loses partial vision, and I believe it's the person doesn't want to see something in their life, refusing to accept something that is in front of them, how does one figure out what it is?
My personal belief about physical ailments is that it isn't really so much where it happens in the body. I don't think, you know, having a heart attack necessarily means that your heart is closed. And I don't personally believe that just because you go blind is because you're not accepting something that is in front of you. I think you have to look rather at what is the effect on your consciousness of this experience. And, you know, like, what is it bringing out of you? What responses is this bringing out of you? What fears is it awakening? What strengths is it bringing out of you? You see, not all ailments are not punishments. Sometimes ailments are privileges, that you have this opportunity to become very strong. You have a marvelous opportunity to develop in ways you never would have. You have an opportunity to reach out and meet realities that you would never have met. Just infirmity and disease is not necessarily a sign of anything being wrong. It might only be a sign of the fact that you're ready to make a big leap forward. So you have to stop and ask, what is happening to me? You know, if I need to be taken care of because I broke my leg, it may not have anything to do with your ability to walk or go where you're supposed to go. It just may be the horror of having to depend on others. It may be have the need to always be in control and be the one who's giving and never the one who's receiving. I mean, you can think of lots of things. Blindness could definitely do that to you. Or maybe one was over-intellectual and was always, you know, reading books and thinking like that, and now that's taken away from you and you have to be more in the heart. You see, many things could be true. So self-honesty. You have to say, what is this causing in me? What's the effect of this on me? And that's your clue. And it might not have anything to do with where it is in the body. It was just the way to reach you. I have a friend who is gay, and I think the reason she was made gay is because she had a terrible problem with anger. And a great way to work with anger was to be gay in our society, in her particular generation. Because then she got to be mad at everybody all the time because nobody was ever treating her right. But I don't think it had anything to do with her sexual orientation. It had to do with the fact that she just needed to work out this anger. So she set herself up. So she was always justified to be angry. So she got to find out what happens if you're angry all the time. That was my personal theory, but that's what I thought was true. You know, so we'd have to talk to her about sexual orientation was useless. That wasn't the karma. Okay. Anything else before we call it an evening? Yes.
So what about, like,
well, if you believe in reincarnation, you see, the child is small today and old yesterday. When a little child asked Swami Kriyananda once, she was about 7, she said, "How old are you anyway?" Because he looked old, but his spirit was unidentifiable. You know, a child just could feel that this was not an ordinary guy. "How old are you?" she said, like this. He said, "Well, I'll put it this way." He said, "When you were an old woman, I was a little boy." And she just looked really puzzled for a moment, and then she kind of got the connection and seemed quite satisfied. So your little baby is in a small body, but they don't have, like, a child's soul. They're on the soul's long journey. It's just a trajectory, and they've finished one body, and they're starting over into another. So if you suddenly find yourself in the beginning of this little square that's going to be your incarnation and you start there, everything that happened back here is exactly where you are right now. So you'll, whatever conditions you're born into, you see, this is very, 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 very challenging. But if you believe in karma at all, you see, you have to believe in it completely. Which is to say that everything that happens because it's an interwoven tapestry, and every story is just rolling itself out as it needs to roll itself out, and infirmity is not necessarily punishment. We have that example right now of that man who's electrifying the world, the man with no arms and no legs. Can't remember his name right at the moment. Yeah, everybody knows about him now. The Australian guy has one little tiny foot, and he's just a trunk. He's nothing else but a trunk. Right, I mean, wow. Makes your problems look really small, don't they? And he suffered a lot, but he has made total victory so far out of what looked like a disaster. And he's inspiring millions. So, like, was it good karma or was it bad karma that he was born that way? Look how far he's progressed. Look what he's managed to do. He's obviously worked out a lot of challenges. And he's not infirm. He just has a strange body. When he dies, there's nothing infirm about his soul. As soon as that body's gone, he's free. And he certainly will have. He certainly isn't sitting in his room and having a tantrum about it. Although he said he did when he was younger. And he credits Jesus Christ, and he has a real solid Jesus Christ is the only way. But look what it's done for him. It pulled him out of near suicide as a child. But now that absolute belief in Jesus Christ has given this man the power to triumph. So hallelujah, praise the Lord, I say. I'm not going to talk to him about Buddha and Krishna. I wouldn't touch it. It's not where he needs to be. Yeah. It's
is that bad karma, good karma?
Well, it depends on what they do with it. And I'm not saying this is easy to accept. It's not at all easy to accept. But if you go down this path at all, you have to have the courage to go all the way to the end of it. And if karma is true at all, if karma is ever true, it's always true. If we are part of an interwoven tapestry, if it's ever true, it's always true. So whether a person takes difficult circumstances and allows those circumstances to defeat them, or whether they make of that grist for the mill for a life of victory, it's a choice. You watch people come out of exactly the same circumstances and they go different directions many, many times. Our society is not popular that way. We're really into blame. Well, we're limited and we're not limited. Yes, you're right. If you're on the freeway and you're going 100 miles an hour and you see your exit and you miss your exit, it can take a little while. You can realize that's where I want to go, but I'm heading this way. It can take a little while before the momentum of your present trajectory can be sorted out, and then you can find another way to get off, and then you have to find another way to get on, and then you have to find out where that exit is. But if it flashes by and you don't want to be going where you're going, you can start turning it. So, I mean, that's a simple, there's a whole huge metaphysical, gigantic metaphysical. Go to Ananda Palo Alto and look for online inspiration, and you can look up karma and reincarnation, and you'll find hundreds of hours by me talking about these subjects. And there's a lot that can be said. Ananda Palo Alto. And it's .org. Or you can look up my name, Asha. My last name for purposes of this is Praver. Asha Praver. And just start Googling there and you'll eventually, you find me all over. It's, you know, the way the internet just gets so convoluted, you'll just find me everywhere. And I answer these questions at great length. And it's very interesting and worth learning. Anything else? We've gone way past our time. I don't mean to keep you trapped. Anyone who feels like leaving, you've been leaving very nicely anyway, so just keep leaving if you want to, but I'll keep answering questions.
What about abortion?
Abortion. My goodness, you just don't really... Yogananda says that the soul comes into the body at the moment of conception. Okay. That when the sperm and the ovum unite, this is how he describes it. There is a flash of light in the astral world, and the astral world is where the souls go between physical incarnations. Every soul that is in tune with that flash of light and is ready to reincarnate, they scramble to get into the womb. They rush to get into the womb. And it's like a little competition is how he described it. I don't know what that means, but the fact is that the man and woman come together, and if it's karmically right for you, and because the sperm and the ovum come together, this, he says, it's right here at the medulla where life starts. I don't have experience of this, but this is his statement. And that from this point, the body is manifested. And this manifested according to the karmic pattern that's there. So the karmic pattern would have chosen you to be born in Africa, to be born in England, to be born white, black, male, female, rich, poor, Chinese, whatever you are going to be. And then, so therefore, from that spiritual point of view, which I've never been pregnant, but every woman I know who's been pregnant knows that there's somebody there. So from that point of view, when you terminate a pregnancy, there's no question that you're taking the life of the, because the soul is present. That's what determines life. There would the body would never grow without the soul being present. However, everybody's in this together. And if a soul inserts itself in a womb where it's not going to be able to come to full term, there's some awareness of that, and it's the karma of the individuals to play that out together. Many people I know have had abortions without having any idea of what they were doing or why. Most women who have abortions, not all, but most, carry something from that. Your experience teaches you that this is not a casual act. It's intensely unfortunate in our society that people don't realize this. So I'm of two minds on it. On one hand, I feel like there's a certain necessity to accept what comes to you. On the other hand, I recognize that many times I've never been pregnant, so I don't know. I've never raised a child. Many times it's just out of the question to raise that child. And God is no tyrant. He reads the heart. There's no sort of, he's not, there's not a rule book that, you know, these are the ones you go to hell for, these are the ones you go partially to hell for, these are the ones you go for hell for half of eternity, these are the ones you go to hell for all of eternity. It's nothing like that. It's we're all working together to make this happen in the right way. That's the best I can answer. But it's a real thing. Abortion is a real thing. It's not just casual. Yeah. Yes. I think that's fascinating. But there's still a point in which the sperm and the ovum come together, and that embryo becomes, you know, it turns from a chemical experiment into a person.
Right. So I guess with research, you know, a lot of sperm and eggs fertilize all the time, so they're literally like this bunch
of souls. No, but they don't necessarily grow. They'll only grow if a soul comes into them. And some of the, no, just because the sperm and the ovum meet each other, a life has to begin. And the life begins when the soul enters and an individual destiny starts. And I think it's all fascinating. I don't know what to think. You have all those embryos frozen. You literally have a soul that's frozen somewhere in that embryo, because as long as that embryo is viable, there has to be an individual consciousness. The scientists are not creating life. They're creating the conditions in which life can start. But they're not creating life. There's a huge difference. And I think it's, I just think it's like, wow, let's see what happens, you know? Some of my friends have babies now that were conceived in a test tube. But there's no reason why the soul can't get in that way if it's meant to be this, you know, it's meant to be this person's child, and that's the doorway in, that's the door they'll come in. But after that, they're just themselves. Yeah. The danger is the hubris that is going to develop, the atheism that develops, the I am in charge on the part of the scientists, and the lack of reverence and the lack of appreciation of a power greater than their own minds. That's the real danger. The little children being born that way to parents who desperately want to be parents is less the danger than the arrogance of some of those who are involved. The potential. I've not met it, but just the potential. I think we better stop. Although we could, I'm happy to go on and on. So any of you have more questions, I have no place else to go, but I feel like I shouldn't keep you trapped to be long. I've kept you much longer than I usually do. It's very nice.
Thank you.
Yeah. That was fun.